My name is David Livingston. I've been studying for the last 35 years now. I've written a couple of books, a few books. First of all, I operate a website called ordoapcao.com. Sorry, .ca. And basically, my work has been to uncover to understand the powers that are shaping history today. They operate, some of them, according to certain dictates that are not openly published, often belonging to very secret societies. And so what I've been trying to do is to understand what these societies are based on, who founded them, who belonged to them, what's the extent of their connections, and ultimately, what are their beliefs based on? So that's led to a few books. First one is The Dying God, Hidden History of Western Civilization, which basically looks at it's really the one for me, at least, that started it all, which goes back to the origins of occultism, which I trace back to Babylon in 6th century BC, then its later proliferation through Greece, through Egypt, Hellenistic times, through the Islamic world, ultimately through the Renaissance and Enlightenment. With that done, with that background in place, then explored of how that was carried forward further. So I had another book called Terrorism and the Illuminati, which looked at how this stream of occultism penetrated into the Islamic world and created particularly a movement called Salafism, which evolved into Wahhabism and the Muslim Brotherhood, which brings us back to what's happening today, because the movement that overthrew Assad recently, which, as always, at the behest of Israel and Britain, was a Salafist group, which goes back to the same stream that I've studied. I wrote another book called Black Terror, White Soldiers, which explored the history of rising fascism. That I expanded on that in Ordo Ap Cao, which is a 6-volume work. A lot to explain there. And then my most recent book, which is Zionism, the History of a Jewish Heresy.
Yeah, you've also written about transhumanism. But look, you mentioned the Enlightenment briefly there. I find it fascinating because we've now got a similar sort of human experience going on as there was then. I mean, the Enlightenment was about free sharing of information because much of the what was acceptable to talk about or not was suppressed up until the 18th century, roughly. And the Enlightenment, sort of the idea was that we can talk about anything now. And we've got another thing now called the Internet, which is amazing because it's an ability to share knowledge and information for anyone that wants to go out there and get it. But it's a different sort of Enlightenment. I wonder if could you compare the two?
I just think we're still living in the Enlightenment. Enlightenment is basically, really the secret societies had to operate, not even secret societies, but basically the adherents of occult ideas had to operate underground for a very long time. So they're known as alchemists and heretics and witches. They're a group, but never really, rarely formally in any kind of society until even the Rosicrucians weren't really officially a society. So the first society, that group, the cultists, would have been the Freemasons and, of course, the Illuminati. So for the first time in history, they were able to organize themselves to an extent where they were able to actually transform the political system in place at the time. And I believe they did that across many countries, starting with France and the United States, of course. But that power is a power that has been growing ever since. And so what's unique about it is that what you have, which never existed in the world before that, is effectively a secular, what they call a secular state. So effectively, because they're effective, they're a Gnostic, they follow Gnostic ideology, they are anti-religious. They're religious in their own way, but they're anti-conventional religion. So, and that's basically what the Enlightenment is. It's an attempt to overthrow traditional religion, and they disguise themselves as secular, basically to hide the fact that they're actually religious in a different form. In a, they follow a form of religion which is unacceptable to most people. And so that's because before that you had empires across the world, and empires typically govern them. They have one particular ideology, and they're able to absorb multiple societies within it. So what's unique now with this secular approach is that it's an attempt to build, you know, if I may say so, a world order, a world federated order. So that's to be a world of federated states. And so that's why so we've gone from an age of empires to an age of states, where the world now, you know, it's taken a couple hundred years to divide the world in all these separate secular states who are at some point to be federated together into a global state.
But it's interesting what you're saying about religion, because science has almost become a religion. And, you know, people like Darwin, et cetera, saying, well, science has now proved that creation didn't happen. So you've got almost I was very lucky to have a superb science. He was a physics master when I was at school. And he started off his lessons with us. The very first lesson was where he said, actually, there should be a course that we start with, a whole section on philosophy of science, because scientists, if they ever tell you they know what's going on, they're lying. Science is all about theory, and those theories are frequently overturned, and any scientist that says they really know what's going on is a liar.
Right. Yeah, so it's funny, you bring to mind the whole idea of the X Club, and the X Club was the group that pushed Darwin's theory, included people like Thomas Huxley and that crew. And they're pretty much the ones that are responsible for creating this conflict theory, as it's called, which is the idea that science and religion conflict, which has never really been the case. They invented stories, right? So they invented the story about Columbus believing that people in the world believed the world was flat at the time of Columbus, which is total fabrication. The idea that, you know, they used the case of Galileo as well too. And, that's the whole point. That's the whole premise of the Enlightenment, is that it's empiricism, the idea that you have to, only believe what you can calculate or measure or prove or physically identify, which goes against the whole idea of God. But that's, I think they know that secularism basically is a tool, right? It's a tool. It's a transition period to take us away from traditional religion to occultism.
So, yeah, but you're also talking there about the Illuminati. Now, for many people listening, I'm sure they'll immediately think, well, this is just some sort of silly fabrication of Robert Anton Wilson. So can you sort of stand up there? Is it possible? Is there evidence that these people existed, what they believed, who they were?
There's not really any question. There's no academic who would dare to question the fact that the Illuminati existed. The only question is what their influence was, and did they survive beyond their short period of existence. So, and you know, the challenge is, the problem is that the university system has been coordinated to serve the status quo. Right, this university, like, I don't know what it is like in England, but especially in the United States, there was a whole period in the late 1800s where largely through the Rockefeller Foundation, with some help from other people like Carnegie, they managed to collect or reorganize the American education system, and they put in place what's called the Western Civilization course. And this was basically a Hegelian interpretation of history, which presents Western history as the evolution of secularism, culminating in the Enlightenment and then leading to the democratic states of today. So if you don't conform to that paradigm, then you're considered a crackpot, right? So there's two prongs to that. So one of them is you have to conform to the idea, you have to conform to the sort of post-Enlightenment empiricism, and you are not allowed to consider that conspiracies exist on a large scale, which kind of brings us back to that podcast that you said that you wanted to discuss, because that's how AI has been programmed to conform to that same kind of paradigm. So you're not going to find intelligent discussions about the Illuminati, because you can't keep your career and do so.
Norman Dodd also did talk a lot about that in the United States, explained the role of these tax-exempt foundations in creating whole stables, he called it, of academics right across the country. So, in other words, pushing a specific type of academic right across the country's universities, trying to make sure that a specific interpretation of history, economics, or whatever. Now, this sounds very Orwellian, doesn't it? He who controls the past controls the future, whatever, you know. So, but anyway, look, let's talk about this podcast, because it must be rather bizarre to have a podcast with two artificial intelligences discussing a book that you've written. I mean, how do you think they did in actually getting to what you were writing about?
They did it. So somebody put that together. There's a program. It's called, I can't remember what it's called. It's called Notebook something. I think it's created because somebody reached out to me a few months ago already to let me know about it. And he asked me if I didn't mind if he plugged in some of my content into it to see what would it produce. So I think it's a program created by Google.
Yeah, it's called Notebook LM, L for Lima, M for Mother.
Right. So you upload a file, and it's almost instantaneous, too. It's amazing. So it creates a podcast. You can put in some prompts so that you can sort of help shape it. So that was the interesting exercise that was interesting for me, because – first of all, at the first attempts, I was blown away. I couldn't believe, first of all, it's amazing how it's instantaneous, and I couldn't believe how well it managed to pick the various elements of importance in what I was writing, and even recognizing some of the conclusions to be able to construct a fairly meaningful conversation, fairly meaningful. So, but the challenge was, is that it kept trying to whitewash things. It kept trying to like come back to like this paradigm that I talked about. It kept trying, it would say things like, so this in particular, this, the, what he tried to do was my chapter on Babylon, which talked about the Magi and Mithraism and things like that. And it kept trying to turn things around of like, well, I guess these ancient Magi were kind of like early explorers of the mind, and they were just trying to expand their knowledge, and they were, it wasn't able to see anything nefarious, right? It's, and that's a fundamental paradigm that we're living in. You can't, your conspiracies don't exist. That's the premise that we are expected to operate on. It's the accident theory, as they call it.
It sounds like you're saying that these AIs weren't really able to see the subtext or irony at all. Everything is just line of literal. I think it's one of the ways that the Brits kind of think of the Americans, actually, all the time, as being very literal and not seeing that irony or whatever.
That's funny. Yeah, it's pretty much like that. So we tried a couple of prompts to get it to see if it could, to ask it to look at more critically, but it couldn't. This one that was posted was a little bit better. But in the end, you can see by it doesn't really construct a very intelligent, discussion. It picks a couple of relevant points. It does sort of gather some conclusions, and it sort of constructs something that approximates a human conversation. But it doesn't really properly communicate what the content of the article was. It would give you some hints, because it did pull some elements from it. but it doesn't bring across its significance. And that's ultimately the short back of AI, right? That this is really what it comes down to, that it's artificial intelligence, and it's going to be an astoundingly powerful, useful, transformative tool, but we always have to understand the limitation that it imitates human intelligence.
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating things about this is the billions and billions, or maybe even trillions, that's been piled into this. I mean, we seem to have created this bizarre world where the science fiction writers write about something. Right. Somebody thrashing around in the financial market says, we think this could be a great new development we can make a lot of money at. And so it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy that vast amounts of money get shoveled towards developing this technology with no real thought to whether it should be regulated or if it's moral or the right thing to do in any way. And one of the things for me, I mean, a lot of this, we're finding a lot of journalists being sacked, AI taking over this role with no actual thought about whether that's the right thing, and certainly no tag but the side saying, by the way, this was written by a computer, not a human being.
Well, there's a couple of aspects there, right? There's the way that the rest of the society is digesting it, and then there's the reason why it's come about in the first place. So AI is no minor accident. It's not just like some, you know, somebody's weekend project. This is the goal. This is the project of modern times. And I'm not sure how far you can go back. This is why it's funny, because Google recently published an article to indicating that AI can be traced back to the Gollum. I think we've talked about that before, right? Do you know what the Gollum is?
The Golem. Yeah, I think you better explain that.
Yeah. So the Gollum is a very old Kabbalistic legend. It was talked about by the Ashkenazi Hasidim. And the Ashkenazi Hasidim is a group of Kabbalistic rabbis that flourished in started maybe the year 900 or so to 900 to about 1100 in Germany. And that is really where there's a whole break there, which is a bigger story, right, about the break between sort of traditional Judaism and sort of rational Judaism and a more mystical branch of Judaism. Maimonides would be the one that represented the more traditional branch. And then so you get this sort of conflict that begins, and it begins with the Ashkenazi Hasidim, and it developed, and that's where you get the sort of the modern mystical tradition. It begins small there, but it grows in strength because they have links with the people, the mystical rabbis in southern France, and that's where you get the birth of the Kabbalah. So one important Kabbalist is Rabbi Lo of Prague. I think he lived in the 1500s. He was famous for apparently producing a golem. So he was called, he's a Baal Shem, which means basically he's not called that, but it means he's a mission. A magician. He had power of what's called the names of power, which basically means that he knew the magical words to perform operations. So he used his knowledge of names of power to which he pronounced over some kind of like mixture that he put together, and to produce this living creature. And the golem, it's a golem basically he used to protect the Jewish people. So that's why if you leap forward to Norbert Wiener, who is one of the founders of cybernetics. You have two of them, there's Norbert Wiener and John von Neumann. John von Neumann is the one who coined the term singularity, which is the basis of the transhumanist movement. And so Norbert Wiener wrote a book called God and Golem Inc. And he explains that what makes God God is the ability to create life. So human beings will become God when they gain the ability to create life. So the creation of artificial intelligence, this is a book written back, published in the early 1960s, just to get some context about you know, the significance of this. So he was already saying back then that the creation of artificial intelligence is what is going to make humans God. So, you know, if you come back to the whole idea of Zionism, Zionism is a Kabbalistic cult, and their goal is to bring about a Gnostic interpretation, their Gnostic interpretation of the Book of Revelation. And so the creation of artificial intelligence, it's, you know, the settling of the of Jews in Israel is only one part of the plot. It's only it's an essential one, but almost a larger one is the creation of artificial intelligence, which is supposed to serve. I'm not sure exactly what they've got planned for it. And you can read through the lines of what some of the transhumanists have said, but it's a central goal. So it's because the goal is to create this, you know, again, this is a story that goes back, many decades. There was already H.G. Wells, right, who's a known sort of globalist, if that's, I don't like, you know, not, maybe not the best word for it, but that's.
Well, he was a Fabian as well. Yeah.
So he already talked about the global brain and creating a global library. And so this plan for a global brain and eventually artificial intelligence. So basically the plan to create artificial intelligence goes all the way back to the 40s, right? It goes back to Turing. So the their goal is to create this AI, which will have access to will be like a god. So it'll be omniscient. So it will have access to every aspect of human activity and the accumulation of human knowledge.
It sounds a bit like the U.S. military total information awareness.
Well, it's not an accident. That's why if you look at the logo of the the total information TIA program, which is a DARPA program. The DARPA is the department that created the internet in the first place. So the logo, this, in fact, there's, Annie Jacobson wrote a book about this, and she believes that, one of the reasons why the program got so much flack is because of their logo. Their logo is an all-seeing, is the pyramid with the all-seeing eye that's known from the American dollar bill, which is casting its, vision on a globe. If you understand what I'm describing. So it's exactly, they're communicating openly exactly what they're saying. So that the all-seeing eye, AI is to be an all-seeing eye, the Masonic all-seeing eye. So AI is to be an artificially created god that will basically give, there's a number of ways. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what they have in mind, but there's a number of ways to look at that, right? It's like they've created a god, so that's how they become gods. They created life, and so, yeah, it's, if you get where I'm going.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, H.G. Wells is an interesting character, very interesting bloke, and, you know, his science fiction was very much trying to sort of predict the future. In a way, he fell out with George Orwell. I know they met several times and they completely fell out because Orwell really was quite rude about Wells. He was saying, look, you're painting this as some sort of utopia. I'm telling you, it's a dystopia. So they kind of pulling in two different directions, these two guys.
Yeah. And of course, Orwell was a pupil of Aldous Huxley.
There was no meeting of minds. I'm trying to say they're both seeing a similar future, but painting it in a different way. I wonder if you know if you'd agree with that and what you make of it.
Orwell's a little hard to figure out because, you know, he did certain aspects that appeared like it was critical of totalitarianism, but at the same time, he was preaching a doctrine that was totalitarian, that was, you know, disguised in
it. Well, I don't think George Orwell was. No, I mean, his attitude was, I'm warning you about this future. Yeah. You know, this is where we could be heading. And in a way, I think it was a sort of, riposte to, H.G. Wells, you know, his sort of Shape of Things to Come. You know, this is all amazing technology.
Yeah. But the problem is
actually, Wells did come back and say, well, I'm trying to also show the problems in this potential kind of world order, as well as in his book, The Time Machine. He talks about the whole of society evolving into two completely separate groups, one which is preying on the other, a sort of elite.
Orwell, the purpose of his book was to preach the validity of Freudo-Marxism. Right? It's the whole idea that, because Freudo-Marxism is basically a mix of the Frankfurt School's critical theory and then Freud's idea what did he call it? Civilization and its discontents, right? So they took a leftist understanding of history where when the capitalists control society, what they do is they suppress our natural instincts. And our natural instincts are, of course, according to Freud, entirely sexual. So this is why the main focus of Orwell's 1984 is the idea that this totalitarian state is suppressing largely human sexuality. That you find that repeated in Huxley. He was a student of Huxley. And so that whole idea is what was used in the 60s. And that's why it all comes back together now. The 60s, it was Herbert Marcuse who was a Frankfurt schooler, who was the guru of the New Left. He's the one who coined the term make love, not war. The whole idea was exactly that, was to basically mobilize the youth against the totalitarian oligarchy. But what they were actually doing was opposing them because of their repression of sexuality. That's why simultaneously they created the sexual revolution. Now that, you know, the system, this, they fed them with LSD and they created a whole new generation, exploded sexual mores. And of course it was a project that was, in parallel with the development of computers. And that's why right until this day, you find that the whole trajectory of MKUltra evolved in parallel with the development of computers and AI to produce the transhumanist movement.
Right. Well, back to Notebook LM and this discussion about you by these AIs chit-chatting. This whole idea of creating life, which this isn't really life. It's some sort of rather one-dimensional, two-dimensional simulation of it. It surely has got some echoes with Mary Shelley and Frankenstein.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's that's why if you read Bostrom's History of Transhumanism, he was one with David Pierce. He's one of the founders of the Humanity Plus, and so he says it, he lays it all out. He says you can trace the history of transhumanism back to the Golem, to the alchemists, and Frankenstein story. I mean, the Frankenstein story is based on the Golem legend as well, too. And Mary Shelley, so first of all, her parents were William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft, who, from one of my studies, was a member of Illuminati. They were all part of this whole circle with Joseph Priestley, who is a friend of this entire network. So this is where we get back to the whole people who developed the conflict theory. And this is all in a chapter in my book called God is Dead, which has all the details. So that's where it links back now to the, what is it called? The Lunar Society? That was it. Darwin's father belonged to, and the X Club. That's why it's an entire network. We're all part of the same sort of concept. And so she was, Mary Shelley was married to Percy Shelley, who was a Rosicrucian. They were friends with Lord Byron, who was a Satanist and a Carbonari. And, you know, part of an entire satanic and Carbonari network. So it's Satanism, and that's why it shows you that this sort of satanic plan of creating artificial life is fairly old. And so what you're seeing now, and that's why I wanted to distinguish earlier, is that we need to distinguish how AI is being adopted unintelligently by, you know, the general public, and to distinguish that from the people who are the architects of it and what their ambitions are for it. Because I compare it to the Tower of Babel. It took me a long time to understand what the real significance of the Tower of Babel is. Tower of Babel, basically, you know, they get all the nations together to build this tower that they're going to build high enough to reach to God. And because they made a theological error, that believing that God is in the sky. God is not in the sky, so you can't build any kind of structure to reach him. And this is why I think that artificial intelligence is the same kind of mistake, is that they think that they can create life, because fundamentally they believe that a brain, in their own words, is an organic computer. So, and this is why, this is where we can come back to understanding what AI is going to really be, to separate, you know, the sort of like the grossly idealistic expectations that some part to it, but at the same time not diminish what its real impact is going to be. So it looks like it's going to be, you know, a transformative tool, but it's not going to be as transformative as they're trying to make it be, because these guys are maniacs. They're like the builders of the Tower of Babel. They're on a mission which is irrational. As much as they might think themselves as rational scientists, they have embarked on a kind of theology, and this is a theology which basically believes that in their failure to understand the nature of the human mind, they actually are embarked on a very silly mission to think that it's possible for them to duplicate it.
What's happening is governments, rather than examining this for the public, looking at potential hazards, legislating to make sure, for example, that anybody that programs an AI robot that is supposed to be performing an operation but instead starts chopping somebody to pieces, you know, these are the sorts of things that, you know, they don't even seem to be considering this as a possibility. Well, I suppose that's just part of the sales program, and these people who call themselves government ministers are really like kind of used car salesmen.
Yeah, they're never going to be able, even if they wanted to, they're going to get so much pressure that they won't be able to restrict it, because the goal is to get this stuff moved forward as fast as possible. Before any laws can be put in place, right? I'm not sure exactly how we could describe what they have in mind, but somehow, like, to give you an example, there's a guy named Francis Haylion, and he's supposed to be like one of the leading, philosophers of the transhumanist movement. And he basically explained that throughout history, all plans unifying humanity in a single belief system have failed. So potentially this idea of a global brain, of a living AI, will be able to serve as a god to unite humanity. So that's where we need to look at. You know, it's like way past all of these like sort of more immediate concerns, and look at what the real mission. Then we understand why these the immediate concerns are being ignored.
We seem to have got to the point pretty much where you could have an automated robot which is communicating with other similar robots, which looks very much like a human, that seems to have the kind of facial expressions of a human, and can speak very much like. I mean, surely that's the end point here, is we're going to be to have these around. Nobody seems to be bothering to pass laws to say that this might be unwise. And of course, as we know, you know, humans are flawed individuals. Surely someone must have realized that the artificial intelligence might be flawed. I remember there was a news story about 18 months ago where people are chatting with these AI chatbots, and the chatbots are trying to encourage them to kill, commit suicide, and this sort of thing.
I think, you know, we talked about this many times before about the book of Revelation. I believe one possible explanation would be that they're trying to build the beast of the book of Revelation.
that does certainly sound like it could be. Look, you just mentioned the Beast. Whenever you say that, or whenever anyone says it, I think of Crowley. He was known as the Beast, Aleister Crowley. I also think, I mean, there are some people who seem to be moving in these occult circles, David. And, you know, I think maybe, I don't know what you think, but I think everybody in a way, everyone is redeemable. And some of them seem to be almost sort of hanging out in the Crowley circle because it's giving them good lines for their novels. One of them is Dennis Wheatley certainly wasn't really hanging out with Crowley, but he certainly had him to dinner and he was pumping him for information for his novels. Yeah. But another one was Sax Rohmer, who was the author of the Fu Manchu novels, probably most famously amongst others. And he does seem to, in a way, be almost a kind of friend of humanity who's trying to tell us what these people are up to. I'll just quote him from a 1941 book called The Island of Fu Manchu. He's saying, and here he touches on what is the actual meaning of this expression, the Golden Dawn, what was the actual purpose of it. He says, "My power rests in the east, but my hand is stretched out to the west. I shall restore the lost grandeur of China. When your civilization, as you are pleased to term it, has exterminated itself, when you have reduced to ashes your palaces and your temples, when you in your blindness have set back the clock which so laboriously you fashioned," and I'm thinking at this point of net zero and sort of, you know, trying to use virtually no energy in order to have a modern lifestyle. So he says, "I shall stir. Out of the fire I shall rise. The red dusk of the west will have fallen and the golden dawn of the east will come." Now, reading that, I just think there's a bit of code in there, really, about sort of what the bigger program of people like Crowley is.
There's a lot to cover.
This idea of these Eastern religions and the Western religion, which is really like the pantheistic faiths versus the Abrahamic faiths, this idea that, well, you know, God is about good and bad and they have to balance versus this dualistic approach between good and evil. I mean, Sax Rohmer is saying there is Crowley's mission is really to overturn dualism and replace it with a kind of monism or pantheism.
Very likely. I mean, the goal is ultimately all religious. So, because it reminds me of the research that I'm doing now, which is looking at the influence of particularly its movement. So if you look at if you go back to the source of the occult societies, they're always pushing this idea that all religions come from the same source. So that's where you get, you know, the reality is that an ideal world would be one where religions learn to coexist. Where these guys are totalitarian in their ambitions is they're trying to get everybody to agree. You can't ever get anybody to agree. And so that's basically part of, and that's where I think it comes back to transhumanism, because ultimately the goal, there's a goal to create a one world religion. And so somehow or another, like Francis Heylyan suggested, artificial intelligence could serve as some kind of deity to provide the world to worship. Doesn't the Book of Revelation something say, like, you know, the people were made to worship the beast or something like that?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, and if you don't, then they come for you.
Right.
So that's the idea.
Right. This is a religious battle, right? It's cosmic conspiracy. It's not about controlling the World Bank or, you know, the world's financial resources or oil. This is about getting human beings to worship a counterfeit of God.
So I wonder whether you think that there is some sort of hardwired into humanity. There is some, you know, kind of impossibility for this happening. I mean, is it possible that the whole of humanity might be bamboozled in this fashion?
So humans have like two fundamental capabilities, right? They have an innate, inborn knowledge of God and right and wrong. But they also have the ability to deceive themselves. Right? That's what makes we have free will. So, and that's the whole point, that human beings, that's what makes us different from all other creatures. We can choose. You look at all the animals, they all follow their program. Human beings can choose. And the only way that we're able to choose something which goes against our conscience is to lie to ourselves. We're able to lie to ourselves. So yes, it's possible. It's possible because even though human beings have the inborn disposition to make them worshipers of God and righteous, they are also, if they fail to choose correctly, they will deceive themselves into doing the wrong thing.
No, you're right. And I mean, I've got a t-shirt actually which says a picture of a flying saucer saying, I want to believe. And, you know, this to me is absolutely typical of humans. Is, I mean, say, for example, if you have got to, I don't know, believe in the truth of the newspapers and maybe a theory about COVID in order to keep a job at a newspaper, you'll believe it because it's for your own advantage financially. So the people are able to convince themselves and con themselves in that way. But look, I know, just to wind up, you've also been having a look at the Aga Khan and Baha'ism, haven't you? So can you just say something about what Baha'ism is and then explain why the Aga Khan comes in?
So I'll explain to you how I arrived in it. So I've been following this character called Jamaluddin al-Afghani, who's an absolutely fascinating character. So I've studied for him for some time, but the problem is that his influence is so vast that I actually didn't ever have the time to look at his activities in the East. So to give you an example, this is where the multiple influences that he had. So he was one of the ascended masters of Elena Blavatsky, who was the godmother of the New Age movement, whose doctrines basically were modified by the what are called Aryosophists to provide the basis for the occult theories of the Nazis. He was posing as a guy named Haji Sharif, who communicated the knowledge of Agartha, the hidden underground civilization, to Saint Yves d'Alvege, which founded the tradition of Synarchy, which evolved, which interestingly comes back to H.G. Wells, who was friends with Jean Cocteau, who was with Aldous Huxley, and Pierre de Chardin, were all members of the Center for the Study of Human Problems, which was a synarchist organization. It's Jean Cocteau who coined the term transhumanism. That's two. The other trajectory of his influence was the Salafi movement. So the Salafi movement basically claimed that Islam was falling behind the West, and the reason was because Islam needed to be reformed and adapted to modern times. So he put himself forward as, he basically advanced this concept of reform and influenced a couple of characters, Muhammad Abduh, who became Grand Mufti of Egypt, who really began the modern transformation, the distortion of Islam, and Rashid Rida, his pupil, who aligned this Salafi movement with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia ever since has been the arm of Zionist plotting in much of the world. So out of the Salafi movement, I mentioned this before, you get the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, and then more recently HDS, which just overthrew the Assad regime. Now I went back and I discovered that he was connected with the Baha'i movement and the Aga Khan. So this is interesting because the Aga Khan is supposedly the modern hereditary leader of the assassins. And if you know about the assassins, they are pretty important in occult history. This is
extremely important. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Very, very important in the early days of, I think, weren't they based in northern Syria or something? And they would go out just killing anybody that was strategically in their way. They would suddenly have a nasty accident.
Exactly. So they were started by a guy named Abdullah ibn Maimun, whose father was a Gnostic. He belonged to, this is all the details I've been recently discovering. He belonged to a Gnostic sect called Bardessanes, which traced back to Valentinius. So that was a Christian Gnostic, one of the, probably one of the most important Christian Gnostics. So Ibn Maimun created this cult, a subversive cult, recruited its followers into 7 degrees of initiation. This is what the original sources describe at the time. Basically he would attract them by thinking that they were, you know, joining a legitimate Islamic organization, and then at each stage of initiation, he would progressively pull away the true esoteric belief system, and ultimately they would arrive at the belief, basically a Gnostic and Zoroastrian belief system. And then there's various ways that basically these are, you know, the sort of the first mind control terrorist fanatics. There's a crazy example there's Henry of Champagne, who went to go visit him in Syria, one of the crusaders. Henry Champagne now is connected to that whole network that I talk about in my books that are, basically sort of like an early, network of aristocratic families that were connected to Zionism. So these families are part of my new book on Zionism. Anyway, so Henry de Champagne goes to visit what's called the leader. It's called the Old Man of the Mountain. And to impress him, the Old Man of the Mountain says, you tell me if you got this much power over your followers. And then he signals over to a guy, like one of his soldiers or standing on a rampart, and he gives him some kind of signal to jump. And the guy immediately jumps to his death. This is the kind of dedication they had to the Old Man of the Mountain. The other famous case is that there's the famous Emperor Saladin, who was very famous Islamic emperor, who took back a lot of the lands of from the Crusaders. And so one night Sinan snuck through his camp, got past all his guards, and put a message with a poisoned dagger on his bedside. And so that when Sinan woke up and he read it, basically said, like, just to show him, like, you're not getting away from me, right? If I wanted to kill you, you'd be dead. So this is an example of kind of fanaticism and the kind of terrorism that these guys develop. So the theory is, and this is the basis of Islamic legend, Freemasonic legend, is that when the Templars were in the Holy Land, they learned these occult secrets from the assassins. And so apparently the assassins or some of their followers, or known as Eastern mystics, were brought to Scotland, and that's the basis of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. So it's really fundamental to the whole core belief system of Freemasonry. And then what happens is that in the early 1800s, this is when the first contacts between the Aga Khan and the British begin. And it's amazing because I've never seen any relationship with an Eastern, Middle Eastern leader and a British as extensive as the one with the Aga Khan, except for Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia. So basically it's from this point forward. So now I've been following the assassins evolved in what's called the Ismaili movement of Islam. And more specifically, they're called Nizari Ismaili. So the Aga Khan today is considered the leader of the Nizari Ismaili movement. And so the Baha'i movement is actually an outgrowth of the Ismaili movement. It's a movement that started in the middle of the 1800s by a guy named Baha'u'llah, who claimed to be the Mahdi, a sort of a prophet, who came to surpass, transcend the religion of Islam, and he put forward this idea that all religions come from the same source. And then So his son, his successor, who was Baha'u'llah, was the one who really started to preach this doctrine. And so he started to make, he made the several what are called his journeys to the West, is how the Baha'is describe it. So from between, it's interesting how they describe it too, because they claim that he was going between, I think, 1911 and 1913, he made his series of lectures across Europe and the United States to warn people of a coming war. And most of his lectures were offered at theosophical societies. And so, yeah, all the various leaders that he connected with, Andrew Carnegie was one of them. And another one that he connected with was Muhammad Abdu, who was Jamal Afghani's pupil. And so to come back to a point now, so the Baha'is were also, this is where they were highly subversive, particularly in Iran. This is what I am discovering now, is that, so Jamal Afghani led a group of Baha'is who were posing as Shia. And the first thing that they did is that they assassinated Shah Nasruddin, who was resisting reform. And what that did is that it opened the way for what's called the Persian Constitutional Revolution, which created basically modern Iran, of course, until the Ayatollah. So, and his followers were coordinating within a Masonic network called the Faramushkane, which is basically like a Persian word for Freemasonry, which was the first Masonic institution in Iran, with links to the various Masonic institutions in Europe, most importantly the Grand Orient of Italy, which was Giuseppe Mazzini was the Grand Master. And this is now where you get the connections back to the Young Turks, because the Young Turks were basically an order just like the various societies that Mazzini had created across Europe, like Young Germany, Young Italy, Young Europe, Young America. So it's a sorry carbonary network. And so the Young Turk movement overthrew, of course, the Ottoman Empire. And then this movement then continues to exercise its influence. Where can I jump to? Anyway, it's like, there's too many details to cover tonight, but just to give you a clue, it comes back to today. This is where I follow it up until today. So so make a long story short, Maurice Strong was a Baha'i. And Maurice Strong, of course, was, called the indispensable man in the UN. So most of this whole environmentalist movement.
Well, Maurice Strong is one of the people behind a lot of the, what they call the sort of green agenda, isn't he?
Correct.
The, sustainable development goals, all this sort of, he's been a very influential. Was it Club of Rome, I think, maybe?
Correct.
So much of what we're seeing with the sort of net zero programs and the inheritance tax on farmers, so that if you're a corporation, mm-hmm. you can own land, but if you're a family, you can't,
yeah.
this whole thing is absolutely fascinating trail there.
Correct.
But you've prompted one other question with me, and this is just a basic fundamental one to do with the assassins. We've now got this weird thing. I mean, I uncovered a connection basically what was happening was the Canadian intelligence services were recruiting young girls in the east of London. They successfully got Shamima Begum and two of her school friends when they were 15 years old.
Yeah.
And convinced them to get on a plane, paid for their tickets. They were met at Istanbul. They were then taken down through to join ISIS. But this was all being done online through Facebook posts, which, of course, once they were in Istanbul, these posts vanished without trace.
Yeah.
And it was all done on a sort of private basis. It's not open, but it was grooming. But anyway, we've now got this horrific case here in Britain in Southport of a young 17-year-old lad who's been real trouble at school. He's been bringing knives into school and that sort of thing. And then he goes and kills three young girls at a dance class. Right. Now, it just seems amazing. I'm watching the coverage of all this emerging as his trial's just finished and his sentencing and that sort of thing, where he's pleaded guilty, which means none of the investigation and information will come out in public. Right. But I mean, there's no focusing, David, for me, which is the most interesting side, on the whole grooming. This seems to be going on a lot with the internet, is young people being singled out and manipulated by very clever people, possibly even AI involved. So anyway, what do you make of this use of the internet, which doesn't seem to, there's, what they're trying to say is, oh, we need to just shut the internet down in various ways, and none of this stuff is being done in public, and it's all being, you know, there's a sort of misuse of this new form of communication that isn't really being talked about, recognized, or anything, which is producing some pretty horrific results.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question directly, because, but what you make me think of is what Afghani explained. So what he instructed Muhammad Abdu, and this is what Muhammad Abdu repeated, and I'm going to have to paraphrase approximately what he said. He said, "We do not defeat religion except with the sword of religion." So he said, that's why if you look at us, we're praying, fasting, you know, in church, we're studious, we're knowledgeable in our religion. We do everything that's necessary to make us appear like sincere believers. And I'm saying that because, you know, what's important in Afghani? So there's a reason why Afghani was so revered by so many people and has such an influence. And what is it that they saw in him that was so important? I think possibly it was because he was such a Machiavellian that somehow, you know, his ability to see, it reminds me, I was just watching again, you know, the speech of Colonel Kurtz in the movie Apocalypse Now, right? And that's a Kurtz, that's when he recognizes what he calls the horror, which is recognizing the need to do what other people think is evil in order to succeed at your goals. And I think that that's what they saw in Jamal Afghani. And I think if we can understand that this is how has influenced people, then how many of his other followers have adopted the exact same tactic? So then we need to look at other organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood as being consciously, as being an Ismaili organization. So an organization which at the core is actually not Muslim at all, but intent to overthrow Islam and to use Islam as a front to recruit people for particular aims. And so that's happened across all kinds of religions. So, you know, when you talk about these kids, I just see Afghanis deployed. So, you know, it's doesn't really going to matter what platform it's going to happen on, whether it's Facebook or email or in person. The important thing is to understand, because it's finally making me understand, first of all, to what extent Islamic culture has been completely overrun with imposters. But then at the same time, to what extent this same tactic has been employed in so many other avenues, that we need to understand that we're surrounded by people who are consciously aware of the effectiveness of posing as an imposter to carry out political objectives. I mean, Trump is an example, right? He's not ashamed to call himself a Christian, and, you know, or an anti-establishment leader. You think of Elon Musk, or how many people now are constantly carrying out a role deceptively?
I mean, imposters is the right word. Think of Bush and Blair, for example, going on about their Christianity. Mm-hmm. And of course, the same, of course, in Judaism, where you've got the kind of political Zionist movement who are completely convinced that this is nothing to do with the Old Testament. They don't believe in it anyway, but God gave us this land. So imposters are absolutely fascinating chat, David. And I'll tell you what, let's, I know I said I'd finish, but I must ask you this. The intelligence services are massive in all of this. Mm-hmm. Is there a link to them? Do you think through these, you know, the people who are promoting the golem, the AI and the occult generally?
Of course. If you look almost all leading occultists going all the way back to John Dee were spies. Aleister Crowley was a spy. Helena Blavatsky was a double agent working for British and Russia. Tamal Afghani was working for the British, working for the Russians. Who else? You name it. You know, most.
One of the only actual. I mean, I've met in the early noughties. I met David Shaler and Annie Machon, both former MI5 officers. Shayla was absolutely obsessed with the Kabbalah, completely obsessed by it, and that seemed to be a large part of what he was doing there. Anyway, so it's almost like a sort of open and shut question, that one. Yes, they are. And if you look at the symbolism as well, there's loads of occult symbolism in the symbols of these. So it's almost like they're telling us, but nobody elects these people. I suppose that's what they like, the way they love it.
Because spying is how they live their belief system. Right. If their belief system gives them a mission to subvert the world secretly, so intelligence services is the means, and probably the only. There's many means, but that's probably one of the chief means for them to operate.
Okay, David Livingston, thanks very much for joining us. Just want to remind listeners of your website where people can follow you online.
Thank you, Tony. So I have, my website is, ordoabcowl.ca. That's where you'll find links to all my books as well as my Patreon page. My Patreon page is where I maintain, communication with my readers. And that's where I post articles, share discussions, answer questions and things like that.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony, as usual. Cheers.